Hello again, everyone. Welcome to the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. My name is Brian Dinovellis, and conference play is about to tip off in the Big East. Great time of the year as teams wrap up their non-conference schedules. It was rivalry weekend, and boy, oh boy, no matter what happens with Rutgers and Seton Hall, no matter what the records are, no matter what the point spread is, one thing is for certain, this game is going to be more exciting than not. There's likely going to be some fireworks, and it's likely going to be decided by about 6 points or less. History repeated itself again. We're going to get to Rutgers and Seton Hall. We're also going to get to UConn. The Huskies have clearly put Maui in their rearview mirror. Reports of their death have been greatly exaggerated, and UConn is back. Mush you, Huskies.
UConn, Huskies, UConn, Huskies, Huskies, UConn, woof.
The chants from Madison Square Garden started well before tip-off. We're going to talk about Gonzaga and UConn, and that game had, oh boy, did it have a March feel in December. That was one heck of a way for UConn to end the non-conference slate. So we're going to talk Rutgers-Seton Hall. We're going to talk UConn, and we're going to get into the Northeast Conference because Central Connecticut and Wagner have established themselves as the two teams to beat at the top of that conference. We're going to get to all that in just a little bit. But first, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Mike Supa of RE/MAX Revolution. He is a trusted name in real estate. And if you're looking to buy, sell, or list a home down the Jersey Shore, we're talking Monmouth or Ocean Counties, give Mike a call, 201-988-2577, and tell him that Brian sent you from the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. All right. Dylan Harper, he just keeps adding his name into Rutgers lore. And I tweeted this out. The guy hit the number one shot on Saturday in college basketball, throwing a knife into the side of Seton Hall, just like J.R. Inman did back in 2008. Just like his brother did to number one Purdue 3 years earlier on that same court. Dylan Harper is not only the best freshman in the country, he is the best player in the country. Okay? If he continues on this pace, what he's doing, he will not only be a first team All-American, he will win Player of the Year in college basketball. When you do what he did to end this game, and in the entire second half, he put Rutgers on his back. Seton Hall did everything they could. They followed the game plan. They played a masterful first half. They were winning at the end of the first half with defense. They took Rutgers out of their game. They forced 11 first half turnovers. They took care of the ball. Ace Bailey was the only one who kept Rutgers in this game in the first half with 15 points. But after halftime, Seton Hall picked up where they left off, and they built a 10-point lead in this game. It was 41-31. 41-31, and that building, Rutgers fans, all they could think about was, we're going to lose to Seton Hall again? Not again. 2 years ago in the same building, Rutgers beat them 45—Seton Hall beat them 45-43 in a very similar game where Seton Hall dictated tempo and pace, and they willed their way to a win in that game, in a game that Rutgers should have won and was the better team coming in. And it was deja vu all over again. It was a 10-point Seton Hall lead. And then things turned. Essentially, Steve Peichel handed the keys to Dylan Harper and said, you need to get us out of this. And Dylan Harper started driving. They started ISOing Dylan Harper. They got away from ball screens. and they started getting Dylan Harper the ball on the court where he could take his man and score. And he hit some tough shots, okay? But he put this team on his back. Now listen, he had help because Jordan Durkak, you've heard me praise him time and time again on this podcast, and Rutgers fans know the value of Jordan Durkak because Rutgers does not win this game without the heroics of Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey, who, my gosh, I mean, what more could they have done with 24 points and 21 points? But don't think for a second that Rutgers wins this game without Jordan Durkak. His stats are never going to blow you out of the water. 9 points, 5 rebounds, shot 2 of 5. But what he did was he got a few rebounds. He got an assist. He drove the ball. He got fouled and hit 5 of 6 free throws. And if you watch that game, he was a major thorn in Seton Hall's side. It was Bailey in the first half, Harper in the second half. But what Harper did was make Seton Hall guard him and find the mismatch. And Seton Hall had no answers for him. Meanwhile, at the other end, Seton Hall got away from its offense. I mean, look, both teams shot near 50%. Rutgers was 53%. Seton Hall was 46%. So statistically, they were even in this game. All right? Where Rutgers had the clear advantage was they had the two best players on the court. And sometimes when you play, if it's a rivalry or whatever the game is, when you have the best player on the court, you have an advantage. When you have the two best players on the court, now you have a significant advantage if you're not able to contain them. And Seton Hall was not able to contain Bailey in the first half and Harper in the second half. But then it set up the last play of the game. Isaiah Coleman, all right, after Seton Hall had given up the lead in this game, after they squandered a 10-point lead, it kind of went back and forth. Coleman hit a 3 to put Seton Hall up. And then Bailey answered at the other end with, his only bucket of the second half. It was close to it. Hit a 3 to put Rutgers up. And then it kind of went back and forth. And it looked like Rutgers was going to take control of the game. They were up 4 with a couple of minutes to go. But Isaiah Coleman brought Seton Hall back again. I think he had their last 7 points and 9 of their last 11 points. The only other one was a dunk by Manny Okorafor. And Coleman was so clutch, all right? While Rutgers was nearly choking this game away at the free throw line, they missed 15 free throws. This was, I know a lot of times we live in the present, but this was the worst free throw shooting combined from two teams that I have ever seen, ever. The teams took 41 free throws and missed 22. Let me say that again. The teams took 41 free throws and missed 22. They missed 54% of their free throws. Combined, they shot 46%. I have never seen a worse exhibition from the free throw line. And twice in the final moments, Ace Bailey missed both free throws. Dylan Harper missed both free throws. Two of the best freshmen in the country missed 4 free throws, opening the door for Seton Hall. And Isaiah Coleman got fouled with 6.9 seconds to go. And he hit both free throws. He had 4 pressure-packed free throws that he hit in the final couple of minutes to keep Seton Hall in the game, tie the game, and give them a chance to send it into overtime. Now, Rutgers calls timeout after Coleman ties the game, and Everyone in the building knows who was getting the ball. Everyone knew it was going to Dylan Harper. And Harper still made the play. And I'm going to talk about it from both perspectives. Jordan Dirkak inbounding the ball for Rutgers. And Harper gets the ball. Garway Duol is attempting to guard him. And Harper put an inside-out move with his right hand, faked out Duol, spun him around, and basically had a clear path to that Jersey Mike's logo and pulled up from 29 feet and buried it at the buzzer. You don't even have to look at that replay. Game over. There's something about the Harper brothers. Amazingly, they just have it in their blood and their DNA. Dylan Harper did it against Purdue at the buzzer, and 3 years later, nearly to the day, I should say Ron Harper Jr. did it to Purdue, and nearly 3 years to the day, his brother does it. After the game, Harper was asked about his heroics and which shot was better, his or Ron Jr. Here was the response.
His shot was better, but I think mine was more meaningful just because of the game and the type of environment and just the rivalry and just all the wins and losses that have been through his program.
I like both of them a lot.
Leave it to Steve Peichel. I like them both. Of course he does. The Harpers got it. And Rutgers is so glad they have him on their side. He was amazing in this game. And what he did, putting this team on his back, he is the best player in the country. He's a first-team All-American. I think he's the best player in the country overall. This was a game that Rutgers had to have. They could not afford a quad four loss. This would have damaged them more than the Kennesaw State loss. They could not afford to lose this game, and they were within a whisker of this game, an inch, a half an inch of this game going into overtime, and who knows what would have happened there. They get the win on a night they had 15 turnovers and they missed 15 free throws. Say what you want about it. I'm looking at it glasses half full. They found a way to win when they had 15 turnovers and they missed 15 free throws. This team is still young. They're still trying to figure it out. That shows growth. The ability to overcome both of those. Now, it also shows youth and inexperience. Not hitting free throws and turning the ball over. So they need to get those cleaned up. So it's both. It's glasses half full, glasses half empty. But if you're looking for positives, they found a way to win. And that's all that matters come March. This was not a loss. It's a W. And in this rivalry, you know how hard they are to come by. This is Rutgers' second straight win in the series, all right? The first time they've won two in a row since 2013. So it's been 12 years since Rutgers has won two games in a row in this series. So that's big. They get the hardware. They get the trophy. And Steve Peichel can breathe a big sigh of relief.
We're growing, you know, and this group has been, you know, tough and resilient, and we're figuring out. I mean, we've done a good job not turning the ball over. Today we did. We've been making free throws today. We don't, you know, but you still have to figure out a way. You know, this journey takes you on many different paths, you know, and, you know, I always say this too. People don't realize the other team's good too, and they're trying to win. And Shad does an excellent job, and they got good length, and they got athleticism, and the way they rebound the basketball, and the way they steal it. They a lot of steals, and then they hold the ball. So they play at a different kind of pace. You know, Penn State up and down, average 90 a game. These guys, you know, want to take time off the clock and play at a different pace. So our team's got to learn from all the different, you know, styles that we're playing. And, you know, but I tell them all the time, you still got to figure out a way, you know. And they did tonight, and hopefully they continue that.
So that's the Rutgers perspective. Rutgers gets the win. They can move on to Princeton. And now they're going to be tested by a couple of Ivy League teams in the next couple of weeks, Princeton and Columbia. And again, tricky games coming up for Rutgers. So that's going to be a very interesting game, neutral site game at the Prudential Center. Rutgers fans, Princeton fans, get to that game Saturday at noon. Bring some fans to that game. There's 10,000 in the lower bowl. I want to see at least 8,000 at this game. It would be great if that game sold out, but get at least 8,000. Because let's face it, you're the State University of New Jersey. You get 8,000 at home, get 8,000 at the Prudential Center. I'd love to see it filled with 10,000. So that's the Rutgers side of this equation. Now let's talk about the Seton Hall side of the equation. It was a brutal loss. Right up there, like I said, in 2008, when J.R. Inman banked in a three-pointer to stun everybody at the Prudential Center. Now, that game, Seton Hall, I think, had an 18 or 19-point lead in that game in the second half and blew it. And it seemed like they were going to win it right up until the very end. This game, yes, Seton Hall was in control, but they never had a huge lead. 10 points is certainly, you know, is certainly within reach of any team. So I'm going to begin with the defense on the last play, and then I'm going to get to the positives because there were a lot of positives in this game for Seton Hall. The last play, I have seen it a dozen times, and everyone wants to say, what was Garway Duall doing? Not guarding, not giving any type of effort, because at least it seemed that way. I'm not saying there wasn't effort there. What I'm saying was it was some of the worst defending I've ever seen on a final play by one person. Collectively, Rutgers, basically all they were doing was Durkak was inbounding the ball to Harper. Now, go back and watch this. This is what you'll see. Chauncey Jenkins is with Durkak, and he is not guarding the ball. Okay, so he's not guarding the inbounder. Instead, he's standing in the vicinity of Harper. Then I see Duall look over toward the bench, but you can't see it in the frame. Duall looks over to the bench. I'm assuming he's looking at one of the coaches, maybe Shaheen. I can't tell. But he kind of looks in the direction of the bench, and before Durkak inbounds the ball, Duall kind of waves with his left hand. And at that moment, Chauncey Jenkins falls back behind Harper. Durkak inbounds the ball, and now it's one-on-one. That's a waste of a defender. I don't know who made that decision, player or coach, but you have Jordan Durkak, all right, and you have Dylan Harper. There is no one else in that backcourt to throw the ball to. Not Ace Bailey, not PJ Hayes. There is no one else in that backcourt. Everyone's in the front court. Why aren't you double-teaming Harper? He should have never gotten the ball. How are you letting the best player on the court, maybe the best player in the country, even get the ball? All right, it was beyond soft. There was no defense, none. So now you allow Harper to get the ball and you have two defenders who could have double teamed him, maybe getting a 5-second call, all right? Maybe force Rutgers into a timeout. Or at the very least, have them inbound the ball to someone like PJ Hayes. They had an opportunity to see that Dylan Harper never got the ball in that inbounds with two defenders. Who knows what would have happened? What if Rutgers calls timeout and now you have time to rethink what you've done defensively and come out with a better defense? But instead, Harper gets the ball. Chauncey Jenkins is, I mean, watch it. He's guarding the air. He's just floating up court. So now you've eliminated Chauncey Jenkins altogether. Garway Duall, who never pressured the ball, who never once turned Harper, who never gave any resistance. All right? There was zero resistance. All Harper had to do was have a little fancy inside out and Duwall spinning around and is 20 feet out of the play. Chauncey Jenkins is guarding nobody, and credit Harper, he made the shot, but it could have not have been any easier. I guarantee you, if Rutgers ran that play in practice, Harper would have been defended a lot differently. So what Chauncey Jenkins was doing, I don't know. Who made the order to get him off of Harper? I don't know. But it was the worst defensive execution that you will ever see in a last second shot of a tie ball game. Horrendous defense. So that's my thoughts on that. All right. Seton Hall just really dropped the ball on that. A team that is known for its defense, or supposed to be known for its defense, and completely was unprepared for that last play, whatever the case was. So let's talk about the positives, because that's all Seton Hall can look at right now after finishing 5-6 in the non-con. It's their first losing record in the non-conference since 1982-1983 during PJ Carlissimo's first year at Seton Hall. That's how long it's been since Seton Hall has had a losing record in the non-conference. So it's not looking good, Seton Hall fans. It's not looking like you're going anywhere this year. But you can hang your hat on this. There were some positives in the second half of the Oklahoma State game and some positives throughout this game. One of them clearly is not free throw shooting, because no matter how much they practice, Seton Hall can't hit free throws. But what we saw was that Rutgers got out of their game. Why? Because Seton Hall pressured them. Seton Hall came out with a purpose. Seton Hall came out with a plan. Seton Hall came out with urgency. And if they play like this, they're going to be in every game. Rutgers shot 53%. It's not like they shot 36%. But Seton Hall worked them. They forced them into turnovers. 11 in the first half. They didn't force as many in the second half, only 4. But you like what you saw from the defense. You like what they saw. You saw collectively in forcing turnovers. They took the air out of the ball. A team that was averaging 80, they held them to 66. And if Seton Hall can hold their opponents under 70 points, they will have a chance to win every game. I truly mean that. Isaiah Coleman is really starting to play well. Had a team high 15 points. I already mentioned 4 clutch free throws. Hit some big shots late. 5 out of the last 7 games, Isaiah Coleman has been in double figures. He is becoming the leader of this team. He is becoming the player that Seton Hall fans and he and the coaching staff thought he could become this year. He's not there yet, but he's becoming that. He should be the leader of this team, and whether he's the leading scorer or not, it's going to be him or Chauncey Jenkins. He is the leader of this team. So he needs to keep playing at this high level. Yassine Toomey has been spotted again. Yassine Toomey, Seton Hall fans, has been discovered. He was MIA for about a month. We have located him. He was found in Piscataway. I can verify that. I saw him with my own eyes. So Yassine Toomey is alive and well, and apparently he can contribute to this team. 10 points, first time in double figures since Wagner. Offensively, he was back to where he needs to be. Another positive. And a third positive from a player development standpoint, Manny Okorafor. Because really, if you talk about all the preseason that he missed, and he missed it all, he's still getting his legs under him. And he took advantage of that porous interior Rutgers defense, because we know what big men have done. And he turned in, listen, Manny Okorafor is not going to be mistaken for Zubi Ejiofor, okay? He's not going to be mistaken for Ryan Kalkbrenner. But for him to get 8 points and a career-high 10 rebounds, that is a huge game. He scored on dunks, layups. His teammates were finding him. He was playing the pick and roll. He was finding open spots and taking what the defense gives him. So you like what you saw out of him. Afterward, I expected Shaheen Holloway to come out distraught. And, you know, he talked about the free throws. People aren't going to make a big deal about it, but he clearly said he didn't want to get into trouble. But then he said, you know, I've never seen a game where one team took 28 free throws and the other team took 13. I know what he's trying to say, but coach, I've seen games where one team has taken 45 free throws and another team has taken 10. You know, Dan Hurley in Maui will be the first to tell you at the free throw line in three games, the opponents were plus 51. So every team goes through it. Every team goes through it home and away. Penn State didn't get a good whistle at Rutgers. Seton Hall didn't get a good whistle at Rutgers. It just comes with the territory. So I'm not saying he's whining. I think if he had to say it all over again, he would not bring it up. Yes, it factored into the game. Yes, it's not why you lost, but there have been bigger disparities. Now, what he did say, and he handled this, and he handled himself very well in this press conference. He answered every question for about a little over 7-8 minutes. And he answered them the right way. And he's positive. He's remaining positive and saying, you know what? I like what I'm seeing from this team. We need to keep doing it. And if we do, we're going to win some games. Here's the coach.
It's coming along. You know, I knew, like I told you guys early on, it's going to take some time, especially for a lot of guys. A guy like Manny, like I said, he gets done nothing in a month and a half. You know, so he's trying to get his rhythm back a little bit. Got to get Chauncey going again. Like, he's a big part of our offense. But, you know, I thought we played well enough to win. I'll be honest with you, our game plan was really good. Our defense was solid. We just, you know, made some plays down the stretch that wasn't good for us. I'm proud of my guys. The guys play hard. Like, we play hard today. You know, this is how I wanted to play. Like, this is how I wanted to play. This is how I thought we was going to play. And this is how we have to play for the rest of the year. If you play like this, you give yourself a chance. Then you just got to make some plays down the stretch.
All right. So all Seton Hall can do is learn from this and move on. Look, it's not like they were favored in this game. They weren't supposed to win. They were 11.5, 10.5 point underdogs. Rutgers, on paper, you know, should have beat them by 15. A young team needs to learn from this and grow. And yes, I said a young team. Why? Because even the veterans, Chauncey Jenkins, Yassine Toumey, even the fifth-year guys, Dylan Dedeawusu is the only guy that's been in this program, all right, as a veteran. And he's a fifth year. Otherwise, they're all freshmen and sophomores, the players who really play in this game. So they need to keep learning as a young team and developing. And now they have to turn the page, and they only have 2 days to prepare for a Villanova team that, listen, they're beatable, okay? They do have one of the leading scorers in the country, Eric Dixon, who's averaging like 25, 26 points a game. He's been absolutely unstoppable. I saw him score 37, a career high against Maryland, and Maryland is a top 25 team. So Seton Hall is going to have their hands full with Eric Dixon, but this game is not unwinnable. And then they have Georgetown at home. Bring the urgency, bring the energy, bring the defense, the togetherness that they've shown that they're capable of, and at worst, Seton Hall can end up 1-1 this week. I really think that. At Villanova, home to Georgetown, why not? Then you go into Christmas, and the Christmas meal tastes a little bit better. So to end this, another chapter has been written in the Seton Hall Rutgers rivalry, and you cannot predict this. You can't. You cannot predict what happens in this game, because the team that, you know, was clearly better the last 3 years lost twice and nearly lost a third time. So this rivalry is alive and well, and don't let anyone tell you any differently. All right, that brings us to UConn.
UConn.
UCANN. You can. Maui is a blur. Maui was a speed bump. This team has shown you the last four games that they are maturing, they are getting better, they are gelling, and UConn is back. And how about the fans at Madison Square Garden? UConn and Gonzaga, separated by about 2,900 miles, whatever it is, 2,800 miles, packed the garden. College basketball, the mecca of basketball, 19,000 fans. This game was played in December between two top 25 teams, and you saw the crowd come out in full force. That atmosphere felt like March. That atmosphere felt like a Sweet 16 game. Man, it was electric. And Gonzaga brought about 2,000 fans, so it wasn't all UConn fans. So give both teams credit. Storrs South was alive and rocking, and it shows you when you have stars, when you have top 25 teams battling, all right, you can fill that place. And boy, that was fun. UConn jumped out to an 11-2 lead. I thought they were going to run away with it. And then Gonzaga, they have great guards, including Caliph Battle, who's playing, I think, his 12th year of college basketball. Caliph Battle was in high school before COVID, starring at Trenton Catholic. And it's been a long and winding road to Spokane, Washington. This is his fourth team in 6 years. He had to redshirt a year. He had the COVID year. He started at Butler, then started Temple, then went to Arkansas, and now Gonzaga. So you're talking about a 24-year-old kid who had a great game. All right, between him and Nembhard, the former star at Creighton, this Gonzaga team, they're tall, they're big, they can shoot. Boy, can they shoot. They're one of the top scoring teams in the country. I think they're second in offensive efficiency. They take care of the ball. So they're never out of the game with Battle and Nembhard. And they brought them right back into this game. This game was a series of runs. Gonzaga goes on a 9-0 run. They take the lead, 21-20. UConn responds with an 8-0 run, back and forth. Just a terrific first half. Hassan Diarra just dropping dimes. He is becoming the point guard that Dan Hurley wants him to become, and he's becoming the point guard that he needs to become for this team to go. You know, 7 assists in this game, 11 assists against Texas, 7 assists against Baylor. I'm not good at math, but that's 35 assists in 3 games. That's pretty good. Or was I wrong in that? 11 and 24? 11 and 14? Yeah, I'm wrong. See, I'm not good at math. 35 assists would be really good. 25 assists. Man, 14 and 11. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? So 25 assists in 3 games. That's still 8 assists a game. Okay, so that's really good. If Hassan Diarra averaged 8 assists a game for the rest of the year, UConn is going to the Final Four. Book it, okay? But he was very good. Only had 5 points in this game, but he had his fingerprints all over this game. And what impressed me more than Liam McNeely, the freshman, all right, and I'll get to him in a second. UConn won this game without their best player, Alex Caraban, having a good game. Alex Caraban could not throw the ball into Times Square. 0 for 7 from 3 and had good looks. They were deep, but he had good looks. They were clean looks. And on a night when Alex Caraban had 8 points and struggled from distance and solo ball struggled with his shot, UConn showed you what a team does. They got a star performance out of Liam McNeely and guys like Jalen Stewart and Jaden Ross really contributed to this team. And Terrace Reed was a beast. But we'll begin with McNeely. McDonald's All-American, top 10 recruit. He showed you why he can be a lottery pick. Had his best game in really UConn's biggest game of the year. In the most famous building in the world, Madison Square Garden. The bright lights, the sold-out crowd did not affect this freshman. A career-high 26 points, hit 10 of 12 free throws. Liam McNeely was huge in the first half, huge in the second half. So what can you say about this star performance that helped UConn beat Gonzaga 77-71? I'll leave it to the coach and Alex Caraban.
Just for him to have that confidence, have that swagger, and really propel us to a win today. I mean, he was special out there, and to do it as a freshman, too, it's unbelievable. And he's just continuing to prove himself as who he is as a player, and his hard work's truly paying off. And to have a game like this going into Big East play, that's all you really need to, you know, just continue to play well.
He's got so much pressure on him as a freshman in this program. I thought his game against Texas was incredibly mature. You know, he's playing like winning basketball, smart, tough basketball. His performance tonight should shoot him to the top of any of these lists I see of the best freshmen in the country, because like he's doing it at both ends. He's doing it on the backboard. He's not volume scoring and there's so much pressure on him because he's our second best player next to Alex.
Liam McNeely has arrived. All right, UConn fans, you've seen him all year, how good he is. But to have this type of performance, you heard it, to have this type of performance in this type of game, in this building, in this atmosphere, that's as good as it gets. This is the first of many games UConn hopes to play in this building throughout the year. So they just got a taste of it. So McNeely was awesome. And in the second half, every time when UConn looked like they were going to take control of this game and they started inching away, going up 8, going up 9, you know, Diarra, McNeely lighting up the crowd, Gonzaga came back. And who was it? Battle and Nembhard. Back-to-back threes, tied this game at 55. And then UConn goes on another run. Jalen Stewart, man, this sophomore, we know he has talent. He finished with 10 points, just the third time he's been in double figures this year. All right, I think he's had 16 twice before. But they needed him. At some point, these players for UConn are going to have their moments to succeed and contribute. And he did, because Jalen Stewart had it. And like I said, Terrace Reed had it with 12 and 6. He's just Mr. Consistency, Terrace Reed. So Stewart hit a big three in the second half. Again, UConn goes up by 10. It was 65-55. And then again, Gonzaga comes back. And who made the biggest bucket of this game but the captain, Alex Caraban, who had a poor shooting night? UConn's up 3 late, shot clock winding down. It's 73-70, a minute to go. Shot clock's under 10. It's under 8. Hassan Diarra drives with about 5 seconds left on the shot clock. Alex Caraban pops free underneath. Diarra finds him. Caraban lays it in. UConn goes up 5. And for all intents and purposes, that was the ball game. So even though he didn't have a great shooting night, the captain found a way to deliver UConn's biggest bucket and seal this win off a dime from Hassan Diarra. Just a great team performance, and UConn has shown you how far it's come since losing to Memphis, Colorado, and Dayton. And oh, by the way, that Dayton loss, okay, is not so bad because the Flyers just beat Marquette on Saturday, and Dayton now owns wins over the Big East's two best teams, UConn and Marquette. So those Dayton Flyer teams are going to be, that Dayton Flyer team is going to be a force in the Atlantic 10. And they just put another feather in their cap. So getting back to UConn, it's all in the past. They have now won 4 straight games, and their last 3 are as good as it gets. Home to Baylor, at Texas, and a neutral site. I know you want to say it's a home court, but that's a neutral site at Madison Square Garden, just like last year's game in Seattle, right outside of Spokane, was a neutral site for Gonzaga. So, big-time wins for UConn. They're climbing in the top 25. They end the non-conference with a four-game winning streak, and now they get ready for Xavier, and that is going to be a big basketball game. Because why? Last year, to start the Big East, we know what happened. UConn came in on a high, and they lost their opening Big East game to who? Seton Hall. So now they're playing a Xavier team that, when healthy, you know, they're coming off a loss to Cincinnati. UConn is at home. I definitely give them the advantage in this game. But they're playing at a good clip right now, and Coach Hurley would agree heading into Big East play.
We got momentum. We're in a good I think we're in a good place in terms of our confidence and our belief that that we could be where we want to be with this team. And, you know, we're excited about Big East play. You know, the Big East, it's such an awesome conference. The regular season is such a war. And we know, you know, Xavier's going to be a heck of an opener.
All right, Big East play. So UConn starts against Xavier, and then they have to go to Butler, Hinkle Fieldhouse, which is always a little tricky place to play. You know, and then they turn the page and go to DePaul and so forth. But you like where UConn is. You like the moxie that they have. You like the mojo that they have. I'm not putting them in the Final Four just yet, but I will say this: UConn is back. So, where do we go next? Northeast Conference. Let's conclude it there. Central Connecticut. Man, I was following this game closely against Rhode Island. I really thought they'd have a chance. All right, Central Connecticut has been a little bit of a giant killer. They have been beating some very good mid-major teams this year that they were underdogs to. You know, they won at St. Joe's, they won at UMass, and if Rhode Island was undefeated, if Rhode Island had not lost, I believe they lost to Brown to fall to 9-1, maybe things were a little different, but I give Central Connecticut a lot of credit. They never let this game get out of hand. They lost by 8 to Rhode Island, 77-69. This game was a 4-point game with about a minute to go, and then Rhode Island made their free throws. They got a huge game out of Devin Hade, 24 points, 12 rebounds. They made some big threes in this game. I mean, they shot it. They shot it well. I think Central hit 10 threes in this game. So it's not like, you know, they didn't play well. It's not like they didn't shoot the ball well. They were in it. But, you know, they hung on to the ball. It was just a good college basketball game. And Rhode Island won. All right, I'm looking up the stats now. So eight three-pointers still, you know. They made 8 three-pointers in this game. It's just the difference in the game came at the free throw line, because Rhode Island shot 28 threes in this game. And what did I tell you? You know, when you go on the road, you're not going to get a good whistle. Rhode Island shot 28 free throws, and Central Connecticut shot 9. That was the difference in this game. I really like what, obviously, how do you not like what Haid did? You know, they didn't get a great game out of Jordan Jones, their best player, struggled. 1 for 6 from 3, only had 9 points. So, you know, they got a good game out of Devontae Sweetman with 11 points, but you got to do a little bit better than that. But I love where Central is, and they have an interesting week ahead of them because Central Connecticut is going to play Fairfield, and they're going to play Quinnipiac. And this team right now, you know, they're playing two in-state teams. And I love the fact that Patrick Sellers is playing Fairfield and Chris Casey, two good friends, two guys who coached at Central Connecticut under the great Howie Dickenman. So it's great, right? It's great that Patrick Sellers and Central Connecticut played Sacred Heart. I've talked about it on this podcast. Those Howie Dickenman Central Connecticut teams in the early 2000s, I think 2002, 2003, you talk about coaching trees, all right? Howie Dickenman descends from Jim Calhoun. Howie Dickenman, so that branch, okay, goes from Calhoun to Dickenman, and then get this, his staff. This is an all-star coaching staff. Howie Dickenman, Steve Peichel, Patrick Sellers at Central, Chris Casey at Fairfield, Anthony Latina at Sacred Heart. That is a staff. That is when Central Connecticut ruled the Northeast Conference. They were going to the NCAA tournament, conference championship. That's when Central Connecticut had its best teams in program history. But Patrick Sellers has brought them back to that, and they are at the top. They were the preseason favorites in the Northeast Conference. Two very intriguing non-conference games this year against in-state MAC opponents. Quinnipiac was predicted number one in the MAC, and Fairfield was number two right behind them. So very, very interesting week for the Blue Devils. They are clearly the favorites in the Northeast Conference. No one can tell me otherwise. But right behind them has to be Wagner, because the Seahawks have won 3 straight. They beat NJIT last week. And we know Donald Copeland can coach. We know his teams bring the defense. They're having a really nice non-conference part of their season. Like I said, they've won 3 in a row. And they play defense. Top 10 in defensive scoring. They allow under 60 points a game. I believe they're tied for 9th in the country, allowing 58.9 points per game. You know you're going to be in a rock 'em, sock 'em, you know, drag 'em out through the mud type of a game, which is exactly what we saw when they played Seton Hall. Donald Copeland coaches defense just like Shaheen Holloway. You know, I like this team. They have some players. I love Javier Ascara. They have some players, and they had a really nice win against NJIT. So Wagner is right where it needs to be. And they have been tested this non-conference. So they're going to be right there in the thick of things as well. You know, they gave Rutgers fits. They gave St. John's fits. And I know they didn't have a great game against Seton Hall, but in those second halves against Rutgers and St. John's, Wagner was right there. They had a very nice win against Boston University. A real nice win, 3 in a row. Coppin State, Maryland Eastern Shore, and NJIT. And they have a MAC opponent this week in Manhattan. Let's not forget, Manhattan went on the road and beat St. Peter's. So Manhattan is better this year. We know that. So this would be another feather in Wagner's cap before they open Northeast Conference play in January. And right now, they're sitting at 6-4. So you got to like where Wagner is. For a Northeast Conference school to have a winning record in the non-conference, that doesn't happen every year. These coaches will be the first to tell you. A lot of times, the best team in the Northeast Conference in the non-conference, you know, maybe 4-7, 5-6. You have Central Connecticut at 6-4. You have Wagner at 6-4. Both teams are going to finish the non-conference over 500, and both teams are 1-2 right now. I think the third team in the Northeast Conference is Stonehill. Stonehill, a longtime Division II powerhouse in New England. I think they're in New Hampshire. All right. They've been great in Division II for years. Years. They're in the Northeast Conference, and that team has turned some heads as well. Stonehill just gave Boston College everything it could handle, and they own a non-conference win over Quinnipiac and Bryant. So Stonehill is damn good. Bryant, we've seen, is very good. They gave St. John's all it could handle for about 30 minutes, and they beat Bryant with Earl Timberlake and Rafael Pinzon. And they beat Quinnipiac. So Stonehill is right there in the Northeast Conference. I think FDU is a notch below those three teams. But the Northeast Conference is always unpredictable and is going to be very interesting this year. I put Central Connecticut 1, Wagner 2, and Stonehill number 3 right now. So that's how it looks in the Northeast Conference. Big East play begins. We'll see where Seton Hall goes from here. We'll see if they can carry that a little bit of that energy. We'll see if it carries over into the Big East. We'll see if UConn carries over that momentum. We'll see if St. John's carries over its momentum from the non-con. And that'll do it for this edition of the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. My thanks to my sponsor, Mike Supa of RE/MAX Revolution. Give him a call, 201-988-2577. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for downloading the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. Keep spreading the word and tell your friends about us. My name is Brian DeNovellis. Give me a follow on Twitter at Brian Dino. Until next time, enjoy the games, everyone. So long.